Welcome to season 4 of And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special events, or buy some of our merchandise, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy And the Writer Is, please rate and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. This week's episode is sponsored by BMI. Full disclosure, Joe and I are both BMI songwriters. So we didn't write this, but we believe it. BMI, we celebrate your talent, value your music, and champion your rights. To all our songwriters and composers, your passion is ours. BMI, music moves our world.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's world-class songwriter and artist released her debut album 12 years ago. She has since penned songs with some of the biggest pop artists in the world, including One Direction, Niall Horan, Maroon 5, and 5 Seconds of Summer. She's claimed the BMI Pop Song of the Year was Shawn Mendes' breakout single Stitches, and the Juno Awards Single of the Year was Shawn's There's Nothing Holding Me Back. These two writers have since become inseparable collaborators, having co-produced and co-written the majority of Shawn's albums, which basically live at the top of Billboard. But she doesn't stop there. This year, she has released 2 solo singles and will be releasing a solo album herself. This Buffalo, New York native is not just an LGBTQ role model, but she once acted with Emma Stone and Rainn Wilson in The Rocker. Look it up. Anyway, I digress. And the writer is my friend, Teddy Geiger.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. That was
You're welcome.
Glorious.
I didn't realize you had acted in movies until I was paying attention, because I've known you as a writer and as an artist. Were you always acting? Did you act when
No.
you were little?
I know. When I got signed as an artist when I was a baby, as a part of the thing, they were like, go out for this thing. Like, Sony's looking for new Sony artists to be on this show to play a musician. And I went in for that role and got that role. And then I got another musician role. And then I did like a couple years of like going out on fruitless auditions, which was terrible.
Why is it terrible?
Because I don't want to be an actor. So it wasn't great. Like, I wanted to be making music, working on making music, and I was doing that all of the time. And then like I'd have to like drive across town, like in rush hour traffic, to go to like this thing in Santa Monica at like 4:30. And I didn't prepare for it because I was like working on music. And then like I'd show up and like half-ass do it because I didn't care. But I was obligated. I was 19. Yeah. And then eventually I just was like, I have to leave LA and moved back home just so I could
get to Buffalo?
To Rochester.
Well, let's go from the beginning. So you were born in Buffalo. I know you lived in Rochester, obviously, because we'll get there.
Yeah.
So you were born in Buffalo. What did your parents do? Were they musicians?
My parents, my dad's an electrical engineer. My mom taught earth science. And
do you have siblings?
My brother, yeah. He went to school for tech stuff. Just got his first job.
Do any
He's
of them?
Very excited.
Congratulations.
My sister's going to art school.
Okay.
No music. My grandparents are musical.
What did they do?
My grandpa played trombone in like big band stuff. I forget who. Tommy Dorsey is the guy. I don't know. He was big on the in the big band circuit in like New York, upstate New York.
Yeah.
So that guy, he played trombone with him. And then my grandpa obsessively rearranges old songs and like combines them with like it, like even now he's 90. And if you go into his room, there's like just like all this sheet music that he prints out. And it's like all this red pencil and just like, he just like, and then he like never quite figures out how to play it all the way he wants it. But he's like been working on it since I was like born. Like certain songs, he's like, yeah, this one's still not quite right. He's just like in it.
Whoa.
And has like this whole.
Does he play piano and stuff
Yeah,
too?
He plays piano.
Well, so there's the music. So do you, why Rochester? They have actually a really good music. I know this is weird, but they have a good music scene. Eastman's one of the best music schools in the world. So
yeah.
I mean, why Rochester? Your family moved there?
My dad got a job there.
Yeah. Right.
When I was like 5 or 6 and we uprooted and moved, or maybe I was 8, something like that.
When did you start playing music?
I started playing piano when I was really young, like 5 or 6. And I got a guitar when I was like 10 and started like, I started writing like little shit. My first song was this song, Little Tommy Blackbird, I wrote on the piano.
Can you sing it?
No, it was something like, Little Tommy Blackbird sitting in a tree. It's like,
sure.
It was like a little melody on the piano that I'd play and sing. And then like I actually started writing stuff maybe when I was like 10 or 11 and I got like a 4-track recorder, Tascam.
Yeah.
And the tape. The Porter Studio, like that one.
Yeah.
And started recording stuff that I would write.
Well, you know, one of our earlier guests is the great John Ryan.
Yes.
So this is one of the craziest facts of And the Writer Is history to me, but you and John Ryan were in a band in high school together.
Yeah.
The odds of that are infinitesimally small. What, when you were in a band with John, did either of you guys realize what was capable in that band? What was, tell me about meeting someone like John Ryan at that age and both of you guys becoming two of the biggest songwriters in the world is just shocking to me. So tell me a little bit about that.
We first met, I played bass in this AC/DC cover band, which like, I literally showed up for like 30 minutes to a rehearsal and then my mom was like, you gotta come home. And I didn't see him again until I like auditioned bass on the phone or whatever. Showed up, did that. Then I saw him again freshman year of high school. We ended up going in the same high school and like, I was like, oh, John, like, remember I came over that one time and played bass and the thing? And he was like, oh yeah. And then he like gave me his demo, which was called Deke. It's like I think there were 12 something songs on there. D-E-E-K. We just listened to it the other night.
Was
very
it good?
Good. Yeah. Huh. And I was like, sick.
Did he play all the instruments on it? Or do you remember?
Yeah. No, he played everything and had like a multi-track recorder as well.
Sure.
And then like I gave him some stuff I'd worked on and we like traded demos.
Were you,
and then,
your demos being on the Tascam stuff?
Well, yeah, but then I would get them off the Tascam via sound recorder and then put them on CDs.
Right. What was your band called?
It was called Faction.
Okay.
But before that, we spent like so much time, like he'd come over or whatever and we'd just like make random stuff that wasn't even band stuff. And then like after a year or so, then it developed into like, okay, we got a bass player. And then that was like more defined sound.
Did you want to be a professional musician, or is that not really something you think about at that point?
I remember like sitting in class and being like, yo, I did, but I also didn't, I don't know. I remember like sitting in class with him at some point and being like, dude, our band's like so much better than a lot of these bands that get signed. Like, and bands are getting signed, we could get signed.
Yeah, exactly.
But like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but I thought that with my bandmates, some who listen to this, so shout out to you guys. But when my high school band, when we tried to play music recently in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And just not really up to par for what you, it's like we were, I think we thought we were maybe better than we were. You guys maybe. Were actually better.
No,
than
but at the time, you know? At the time, like getting signed wasn't, you know, in like 2000, from like the, like 1990 in to like 2005,
yeah.
like.
Yeah.
People got signed. Like, you could, like, have an okay thing, and it'd be like, we're set. Like, it was still kind of, like, that boom, like, coming off the 80s and all that shit. And, it, like, the digital shit hadn't, like, completely, like, taken over, you know? Like it was just happening. Like, the nerds at school would burn you a CD, but not, like, everybody knew how to steal music yet. So it's, like, they were still making so much money that it was just, like, I feel like... It was just like you hear some bands and you're like, oh shit. Like even like what's the band? I mean, and it's really good, but the
Collective Soul.
It's like when you listen to that and how that's recorded, you're like, I mean, it's good, but also like it's not like and then you listen like what's on the radio today. And it's like the bar of like how shit has to sound has just been like raised. Like it used to, you could make some shit in your bedroom and like it would be on the radio. Like, I mean, you still can, but what you can make in, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? I think.
Sure. Sure.
Like it's like that song sounds like it was recorded on like a Fostex, like little like digital four track with like the effects on it. I don't know who recorded. Someone probably recorded it. Like
at the time, but at the time you needed, you know, you need outboard gear to. You didn't have computers that emulated compressors and being able to record even a fake studio in now. You know, sort of sounds pretty good because you can, you know, GarageBand is on everybody's phone and it has compressors in it.
Right.
So it can emulate a studio. And I mean, at the time, I think you could record stuff, but not everybody knew how to use it. Also, kids now, I don't even know if they, a lot of people don't study trombone to start. They get computers and become DJs. And so they start producing when they're growing up. So
And there's so much information online about how to, you know, but before, I guess, where you'd have to like, be the apprentice of somebody who works in a studio and is like knows how to do everything. Yeah, now you can kind of go online. There's like Pensado's place or like so many places to get little tips.
When did you record or write a song with Faction or on your own where you're like, this is not just, you know, you, as you say, you were sitting in class. This, my music's as good as what I'm hearing on the radio. I could do this. I can get a record deal. Was there a song, or were there songs that, where you started thinking, you know, this is the real deal? And you know, obviously, you kind of get discovered around that age, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get discovered? What happened?
My mom forced me to do a reality show called In Search of the Partridge Family, and I didn't want to go because. I had to go like be away from my girlfriend, and I also thought it was cheese ball to be on a reality show called In Search of the Partridge Family, but she kind of made me do it because I was spending all my time doing music, and it was like I was like sleeping through all my classes and like staying up and working on music and like kind of like clearly devoted to it. And so she was like, we have to make something happen with music because it seems like that is either going to happen or like we're like really going to have to figure something out. So I think she was like, cool, this is like a way to funnel all of that. And then I met Billy Mann, who's songwriter, producer, who was working behind the scenes on that show, and sent him a bunch of like my demos and stuff. And then he brought me to meet like Donny Einer and Charlie and Will Botwin at Columbia Records. And then that was kind of the thing. And then he was like, let me make a record with this kid and let's see what happens. And they were like, cool, like here's some money and we made it.
That's crazy. But you're in high school still.
Yeah, I was a junior.
What did the people in your band think?
Like John?
Yeah, sure. Or any of, I mean, any of your friends. I mean, how crazy is it to be a junior in high school and be, oh, I'm going to make an album with a major label because I went out on an audition for...
I don't know.
You know?
I think they thought it was cool.
What did you think?
I know, I had a hard time processing all of it.
How do you think of it now?
I don't. You know? I never really thought about it too much. I was like, cool, I want to do this. Let's go. Like,
sure.
But I don't think I like ever could. And like, even when I heard like my song on the radio for the first time, or like when I'd see myself in publications and stuff, it would kind of like go through me. I'd feel like I was like listening to it on a CD that I made, that I burned. Like I, it never like clicked that it's like, oh shit, this is like.
I mean, it got big.
Yeah.
It was obviously really successful. Your debut album ends up being top 10 on Billboard. And I mean, you have a single that went gold. I mean, you must have gone, I mean, that must be just nuts to be in high school and playing.
It was weird.
Sold out places. And
yeah.
Who's touring with you? Like, are you with your family? I mean,
no, it was
you're not
me.
Even 18 yet, right?
No. Yeah, I started touring and doing all that when I was 16.
Did you think about writing with other people or for other people at that time?
I always kind of looked up to Billy and what he did and was like, oh, I'd like to do that eventually, because I didn't love touring.
I know who Billy is, but why don't you say who Billy is?
Oh, Billy,
he's
man.
An icon.
He's an icon, record producer, songwriter. He's like done a bunch of stuff with labels and publishers as well, and is... sick. Done a bunch of stuff with Pink. Done a bunch of stuff. When I met him, he had just done that song With You with Jessica Simpson, and done stuff with Celine Dion. And
yeah, huge.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have obviously the song starts working, the album's working. Did you finish high school?
No.
Did you ever feel pressure to?
My mom wanted me to, and I like attempted it, and I just couldn't. It was like, because I was juggling all this other stuff, and then it was like, am I really going to go home? And like, I had to like do a phys ed. I needed like a phys ed credit, and I needed like all this stuff. Basically, I took all my Regents exams, like all my state exams, passed all of them, but needed like a citizenship course, and like needed to do another English course. And like, I just couldn't. I have like pretty bad ADD, and it's like I had enough of a hard time like completing tasks as is. And so to like try and do that around like waking up and like doing radio and doing this other thing, and like to try and like slide in a tutor that like, and tutors are like, no, I thought it would be like, cool. Yeah. I do the tutor for an hour and they like sign off on my shit and I'm done.
No, they're real teachers.
No. Yeah. They try to whip you into shape, especially when you're like, yeah.
Did you ever treat ADD with something other than...
I used to take Adderall.
Yeah.
And I stopped.
Why?
Because it was too something. I liked it. And it would help with certain task-oriented things, but also it would get... Now I just drink a lot of coffee, and that kind of can work and not work, but it was so like... I don't know, like if I play you stuff that I made while I was taking Adderall, it's like lots of like small little chops and well-organized drums and like...
super meticulous. And
yeah, it's whereas
it's not as flowy.
Between
2006 and 2010, you know, you release your debut album and then you start working on your next EP, but there's... a lot of time between, and even then, you know, 2013 is really like the, you know, the next time I really see stuff on your resume. But there's a lot of time that happens between 2006 and 2010, if not 2006 and 2013. What happens? I mean, when do you move to LA? Tell me what happens during those years.
I moved to LA when I was 18. I moved back in with my dad when I was 20, 21.
So your parents were divorced at that point?
Mm-hmm. Okay. They'd just gotten divorced, and I was kind of like, I'm going to jump back in and absorb my divorced parent situation.
Why would you do that?
I don't know. It just seemed like the right thing to do, and I wanted to get out of L.A., and I wasn't doing anything to make any money. And I had some money saved, but like wanted to just buy myself some time and like redirect. So I moved back in with him and like set up this little studio room that I slept in. And just for like 7 or 8 months, just kind of wrote, which was awesome. And then I tried to move back out to LA and lived with a friend for a little while. And then was like, screw this. Nothing's happening out here for me. And moved to New York. And I kind of started working with this producer, Mark Saunders, there, who's awesome. He's mixed a bunch of stuff for like David Byrne and The Cure and stuff. And my manager now, Ollie, was managing him. And kind of like, he had this amazing studio in New York and I was able to like use that. And then Ollie started managing me as a writer-producer because that was kind of very much so my goal at that point was to produce and write. And then that kind of turned into me doing sessions again. And then something that I wrote with John and Julian ended up on the One Direction album, that song Little Black Dress. And that kind of like opened the door with Big Deal, who's my publisher. That was, I don't know.
So you're going from, I'm living in my parents' place. You were doing some, that's when a lot of the acting stuff was too.
That was after.
When you lived with your parents.
No, but I lived
in, I moved. The acting stuff was after that.
Yeah, I kind of moved back in to get out of
LA.
Doing, like to just be like, I'm only going to write and work on music, like.
You're done on that.
I'm done.
Yeah.
Not doing any acting. Also, like, I don't want to go in with, like, these people that think I want to be an artist. Like, I don't want to be, like, cutting outside songs and, like, I don't want to be an artist right now. Or, like, I don't want people to put their version of what I should be as an artist onto what, like, I just need time to, like, make shit and, like, play with sounds and...
Does that change how you work with artists who are signed?
Yeah. No, because like the big thing is when you go in as an artist, people assume you don't know how to do. I mean, not any of the people that I've, you know, we're all great. This crew has been amazing. But when I was an artist before, so many people, I should say, you go in and they're like, oh, you're an artist and you're coming to me, so you must not know.
What you want
or what you're doing or, and some artists don't, but some artists do and some artists don't, but they need to figure it out and they don't need something just like, I was getting so much just like shoved down my throat because I didn't, and the other thing is I didn't know what I wanted. It's not like I was coming in like, this is what I want, but also like I knew what I didn't want and I knew what I liked. And I was just kind of getting forced into these situations where I felt like I had to go along with stuff that wasn't. And I just really wanted time to like get my hands dirty and like play with stuff and like figure out how to do what I want to end up doing, you know?
That era in the middle of the 2000s too is a lot of award shows, or not award shows, talent shows and there's a huge push from, you know, Disney and Nickelodeon. So there are all these singers, but no artists.
True.
And so there was this living that people were making by just being, oh, well, let's just get a song on this album.
Exactly.
The album was, you know, and their albums were still selling, and it just mattered to get on a singer's album, and you could just tell them what to do because most of them had just won a talent contest. They weren't getting the record deal because they were writing music in their room, learning how to use the equipment and getting their hands dirty. They wanted to get famous.
Right.
So that's a whole other,
yeah.
You know, and I think everyone mixes those humans up.
Yeah.
They don't really understand that. You know?
It's kind of like, oh, kid, you want to be famous? I got a song. It's like, yeah, as opposed to like, okay, let's like... So I always like to start in the other place. And then if it's the other kind of person, then it's like, oh, cool. Well, we're not going to do much anyways.
So you end up doing... You write Little Black Dress with, you know, John and Julian.
Yeah.
Did you call John and say, no, I'm getting back into it? Like, we should do this? Or have you always kept in touch?
We always kept in touch. Like, when I was living at home with my parents, I used to go drive and visit him at Berkeley. And
yeah.
we'd like to make stuff. And so he was working with Julian in Calabasas. So anytime I'd be out in LA, I would like just go hang out with them and like make stuff. And that came out of like, we made like a 5-song like rock EP just for fun one week. We were all hanging out and it was like a Led Zeppelin sound.
There's probably not
thing.
A more fun crew to do something like that, because there's the no shortage of references and ideas and talent to say, oh no, let's do this. And you just jump straight into it.
Yeah.
An hour later, you're like, this vibe is incredible.
We literally did it. They were just live jams. Like I was playing bass, John was playing guitar, Julian was playing drums. And we'd just jam until we'd have a vibe and then we'd like put it down. And then we had like all the little vibes and we wrote lyrics to them and melodies after we recorded them.
Are they playing on your current stuff at all? Did you write with them at all for that?
That's just all me.
Yeah.
Because the whole point of that for me was kind of to like make something on my own, because so much.
We'll get there, because that's like, obviously that's an exciting thing. This week's episode is sponsored by BMI. At BMI, music moves their world just like it moves mine. BMI is my performing rights organization. They're the bridge between people who create music like me and the businesses that bring it to the public. They make sure I get paid when my music is streamed on apps or shows, played on radio, at live shows, or in bars, gyms, basically anywhere where music is played. And they do this for over 900,000 songwriters, composers, and music publishers with more than 14 million songs across genres. But it's more than that. They help us navigate the music industry. They create opportunities for aspiring writers and composers through stages at festivals, song camps, and workshops. And they connect us with the right people. They're also on Capitol Hill fighting for copyright protection and fair royalties. And they work hard to ensure the future of music. They have my back and they'll have yours. Learn more at BMI.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So you sell just a shitload of records because you end up on One Direction, kind of like right in the prime.
Yeah, that was...
And then
very
you end up
cool.
on more One Direction, right, still in their prime. And then maybe the craziest single for Stitches to work as well as it did is shocking. If nothing else, you have a kid who's gets a record deal off of Vine.
Uh-huh.
You have people who have cuts, but it's not loaded with like, it's not like Max Martin's on it. And it's not, you know, it's not these crazy, it's not even Julian and John at the time. You know, it's
right.
like everyone, you have cuts, but to go and be like, I'm going to have the single on a guy's debut song. Well, I know he had a song before that, but really kind of the first radio song.
Exactly.
And it lived on the charts for, I believe, well over a year. On some chart, well over a year. And on, you know, iTunes, something like almost two years or something like that. The song, it wins BMI Song of the Year. It's over 6 times platinum. You know, number one on top 40, adult top 40, and AC charts and UK singles. I mean, how does that song become that big?
I have no idea.
Does it make you question everything when you're like, why? Because whenever there's a hit song that I've been a part of, it's like, of course that's how that was supposed to work. But, you know, on some level, it's like there's no, you can't predict any of it.
Right.
It's so unpredictable.
That's the cool thing, though. That's the cool thing is like, it is so unpredictable. Even with like the little black dress song that ended up on the 1D thing, we weren't like, let's write a song for 1D. And like with Stitches, it's not like, let's, you know, it was me and Danny Parker started the song and like we were in David Silberstein's office and I had a laptop and we like wrote the first verse and chorus and kind of like called it a day and we're like, cool. And then showed up the next day and DJ Kirikidis joined us, Daylight. And we finished second verse and produced it out and finished the bridge. And then it was like, cool. You know, like another song, like just like the other 100 songs we wrote this year so far.
Right.
And then, you know, it was like, okay, well, this dude, Shawn Mendes, is going to have a crack at cutting it. And it's like, okay, awesome. Like, you guys do your thing. And then I met Sean and we actually cut it with him and he seemed amazing. But still, I wasn't like, oh, this is going to be the thing, you know? Like,
watching that song become what it did for an artist and having been an artist, did it make you want to record music again as an artist? Or was it, oh, I always want to write songs with other people?
No, it was like, yay.
Yeah.
This, because something like that, and like you were saying, it's not like there was like a Max Martin attached to it or something where it was like, it kind of like everybody who was involved with the song, because we were all kind of in this place where it was like, we're doing stuff, but nobody's like busted out or has their, you know, has their like, oh, you know, it kind of turned into this like, okay, but I don't know. It's like there's more of like, okay, let's go to them for more songs and more stuff because we were the core of what made that song happen, as opposed to like, you know, if it was like a song I wrote with Max or something, and then it's like, well, duh, okay, Max, and then like this other, who's this other person? Like,
and something happened around that era where I feel like that's when our whole sort of extended family in the industry all started.
Well, I had just met you at that studio.
Yeah, it's crazy that it all happens right at the same time, because it's not like it really was kind of a bunch of no names, but a lot of people who were in bands together, or not together, but just a lot of people in bands. And I think maybe that's why, is that we all knew what it was like to be in some project where we had to perform. So I think we all see songwriting from in a way, even though I think we're all pretty analytical and have become more analytical.
Yeah.
I think we all joined it because we didn't want to be in bands anymore.
But we,
but we could, but we didn't want to. Like, we wanted to jam out. We wanted to write from like a friend vibe rather than from a, let's see if we can make platinum records. It was more like, let's see if we can hang out and write a song that's cool.
Yeah. It's like, how long can I keep the game of like hanging out with my friends, writing music, like going, and just have people let me do that? And like, that's what all I really have to do. Like, that's my game
today. Okay, so then more Shawn Mendes, and the reason why this is crazy is he's now, you know, arguably one of the top artists in the world, and you guys spend so much time together. I don't think people realize how much time it takes to record and write an album. You know, they just see the 10 or 12 songs on an album. They don't realize,
yeah,
you know, the effort. But you go and you guys write Illuminate together, at least the majority of the songs, including There's Nothing Holding Me Back and Mercy and Treat You Better. At this point, are you guys kind of expecting songs to work? Or was it sort of irrelevant whether it worked?
For me, it's always relatively irrelevant. I like it to work, and I get nervous later, like before they come out. But like while we're making them, yeah, I wasn't really, you know. Also, like we're writing them and playing them for Ziggy, the A&R, and Sean's manager Andrew, and like they're like, yeah, this is great, this is gonna work. So I'm like, cool, you guys know you okay.
That's what you do.
Great.
Right.
Yeah, that's your great. Okay. Trust you.
Yeah.
But I'm always kind of like, it's another song, you know? Like, I can tell when a song is like more catchy, obviously, or like if it feels more like hooky to me or whatever. But I.
One of the worst words in the music business is hit-ish. And someone's like, oh, it's a little more hit-ish. Or it's like, be like, it's a smash. I mean, those two things I hate. But like when you're writing all the time, there's some songs where I really like this, guys.
Yeah, I know.
That's
I like
the kind of hype that that you know, you're not really the type to be like, there's a smash.
Oh yeah,
you're,
no.
You know, you're like, I really like this.
But you know when you what the best is when you like it and it's also it and it's hooky, because it has to be hooky, not like hit-ish or whatever or smash, but like. The best is when it's good and makes you feel something, but also has, there's like that fucking earworm shit.
One of my favorite songs that was a single for music and was not really like a radio thing was when Ricky Reed released Express Myself.
Cool.
I love that song. Not just because I love Ricky, but there's something about that song that I feel like had meant something more to him. And it was one of those moments where you start realizing that we as songwriters and as producers still want to release music that means something to us.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know. Tell me about that song. I know it's super random for me to bring that song up, but
no,
I love that
chill.
Song.
That was amazing working with it. We did a bunch of days kind of around like making stuff for him. And that was something I had like started this little idea nugget, which Ricky's so good at like taking like, you know, I'll send him all the time, like little ideas and whatever. And he'll kind of like turn it into something amazing. But that was one of those where it was just like this little kind of like chord progression drum loop thing. And he was like, that's cool. We should work on it. And then I don't quite remember, but we did a couple days finishing it up, and he kind of produced it out, and
it's so good.
I was hanging out. I don't really know, but I love it.
As you're starting to write, and now you start having just a bunch of releases, you know, just every year, it's just, you know, just so many songs. Do you have any personal life at this point?
Yeah.
Like, were you good at socializing?
I feel okay. Like
when I was working most, that was something I had to work to balance. I don't know.
Well, for me, you know, like my idea of having a good time in high school is like hitting up John and being like, yo, do you want to come over and make a song?
Yeah.
You know, so it's in a lot of ways, like my friend group are the people that I work with.
Sure. Right.
So it feels like I'm seeing my friends, like, you know, and then like I'll get like, you know, me and Danny now like live near each other. So I'll like grab breakfast with him or
sure.
See people for breakfast. I've been getting better. You know, it helped a lot quitting smoking weed because I used to stay at home and smoke all the time.
So quitting weed, you smoked a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You smoked a lot for a while.
Yeah, I'd like go through like one of those jars I gave you like every day.
Because you had it or because you were addicted to it? Like, or is that the same thing?
Because I smoked it compulsively.
Why?
Because it was great. No, I mean, I love weed. Weed's great. I can't smoke it because I smoke it compulsively. A, I have like OCD.
Uh-huh.
So it was like a behavioral thing. And with smoking, it's like somewhat of an addiction, but maybe not quite addiction, like more compulsive.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was like suppressing like gender identity stuff, because when I started talking to like people I know and like divulging all those things, it became a lot easier to not smoke.
Interesting. When did you start? Tell me more about that. Did you start smoking, you think, to suppress certain things? Or do you think it was, you know?
I started smoking because it's amazing.
It's really a creative thing. I mean,
yeah.
Rubber Soul.
I mean, it's
that's what happens after they started smoking weed. Don't smoke, kids.
Yeah. No, I mean, my sister actually, she started smoking a little bit. And I told her, like, just be careful. Also be careful because, like, for me, it totally, like, it can get out of control. Mm-hmm. And it can be something that, like, is a limitation and is more, like, harmful to your life experience or, like, more of a pain in the ass, really, than anything else. Like, I used to just, it was so stressful keeping the whole thing going and having to buy the weed and smoke the weed. And, like, I couldn't sit down for more than 30 minutes without, like, having to roll another joint. But, like,
it's really time consuming.
It gets so time consuming.
But you probably have a lot of free time.
Like, people who can smoke, like, once every couple weeks or whatever and have an experience and, like, do their thing, like, that is great. It's like people who smoke cigarettes who are like, oh, I need to quit. And I'm like, well, how much do you smoke? And they're like, I smoke when I go out on the weekends. I'm like, you don't need to quit. Like, keep smoking. That's great. Like, don't feel ashamed of that. Like, you're doing great. Like, I mean, if you want to quit, that's different. But don't be like, I should quit. Because it's like, do you want to quit? Is it like destroying your life? Or is it like something that's fun that you do on the weekend with friends? It's like, don't worry about it.
Sure. Is it a vice or is it an addiction or two different things?
Exactly. Kind of thing. It's like, yeah. I used to wake up at like 6 in the morning to smoke cigarettes. And I would smoke until right before I went to bed. I would like pound, you know, like 3-4 cigarettes. And then again, like wake up at like 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, smoke.
How did you sing? Did it destroy your voice?
No, you just get used to it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Bodies are, like, awesome.
So tell me more about the suppressing gender identity and getting, you know, quitting weed and how all that rolled out for you. Because, I mean, you have a unique story in this.
Yeah. Well, I kind of came to a point where I was like, I'd tried so many times to quit and I'd come to a place where it would be like this, okay, I don't like doing this anymore. I want to quit. And then at some point I'd kind of just forget and like start doing all the stuff again. And then I went to treatment. My mom like suggested that I look at maybe going to treatment and I was like, okay, well, and I looked at a couple of places and ended up going to a place out here and went into their, like, OCD program because I also, like, had a bunch of OCD behaviors that were, like, popping up, like, some whatever skin picking stuff and other stuff. So I did that, and while I was there, kind of was like, okay, I want to get to the bottom of why is it so hard for me to quit smoking? Like, what's going on with, like, all this gender shit that has been, like, a part of my life since I was so young, and I'm like I haven't been super comfortable talking about it. I talked about it with therapists before, but like never really gotten anywhere, and like kind of told my parents about it because like I was like painting my nails and like dressing in some women's clothes, and my mom was like, are you androgynous? And I was like, androgynous is like a descriptor. It's not like something that you are. Like if you think I'm androgynous, then I am. It's not like, it's like, are you attractive? It's like, I don't know, mom, do you think, what would you?
Right, it's just an adjective. It's not.
Yeah. So whatever. It was kind of like.
How old were you when you first realized it? Whether you could verbalize it or
like
not.
Like 5.
Yeah.
And maybe it was like not until I was like 20 that I really like, I was dating a girl who was going to NYU, and like within that friend group there were people who were less kind of like, I don't know if I even met anybody who was trans, but at least people who were like,
they weren't black and white about it.
Gender line was blurred, and it was like, oh cool, they're just like living that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And I kind of like learned that trans people existed around that time as like a thing. And that same girl, like I'd talk to, I kind of would open up to like whoever I was dating about it because it would be such a part of like my personal life that anybody who I was like bringing in close enough like would kind of have to know, or I'd feel like I was keeping too much from them.
Did you find that most people that you were got close enough that you would let them in, that they were, you know, that they were accepting?
Yeah, they were relatively accepting.
Yeah.
But just like little things would then clash because, you know, like they'd kind of sign up to be dating a man and then it would be like, yeah, but like you're not really dating a man necessarily.
Sure.
Yeah.
When you go to treatment, you start talking about it and then you explain what the next steps are and then it becomes... You know, I mean, I would think that the songwriting community has been, like, totally accepting that you're, like, at least you're friends. Like,
oh, yeah. No,
I feel like this is, like, the most comfortable place that you could be yourself. You
100%.
Know, that's kind of the whole purpose of it. Like, most of us became musicians and songwriters because we didn't fit in normally anyway.
Right.
So it's like... You know, but tell me about the process of not only coming out as trans, but to go through the changes and the process and all that.
Well, so basically I kind of, one of the things, well, there's an OCD thing that's like ruminating about being gay or like trans or whatever, like that can be a thing that's OCD. So basically in treatment, I ruled that out. And they were like, no, this seems like real stuff. Like, and I was like, oh, okay. Then let me like sort this out. And I'd learned a lot about like how shame works and blah, blah, blah. So I was like, you know, shame thrives on secrecy. So like maybe I'll tell. Like I was really, a lot of the people I'd met more recently, I would be more comfortable because they'd met me since like I was painting my nails and they've met me since whatever. So like be more logical. But then like my friends like John, who I've known since I was 12, like, that's where I felt like, oh my God, I've known them in a different way for so long. So they were like the first people that I kind of came out to. And I was just like, look, like, I've felt like you know, me being trans might be a thing for a long time and I might actually look at like taking hormones and like seeing what the next steps would be to like explore that. And I just kind of wanted to like bring you into the loop and like talk to you about it. And then as soon as I did that, I was like, oh yeah, no, I'm like, that's, I'm going to do it. Cause I kind of said it and I texted them and I wrote up this text that was like, I think I might look in. Yeah. And they were very accepting and were like, yeah, cool. Like it was kind of
right.
Like,
exactly.
Sure. Yeah. What, like
in the, you know, it's almost anticlimactic whenever the rest of the world, you know, everyone has their own life going on. So they're like,
yeah, they're
oh,
like,
cool.
Whatever.
Nice.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're sitting there like brewing over
like,
it and
fuck,
everyone else.
This is like, yeah, this is
No, guys, this is huge. You're like, yeah, it's totally huge.
But like, sure,
awesome.
Yeah, do it. Yeah, amazing.
It.
Good.
We got you back.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah. So then, yeah, after that, it became like, okay.
Did you find yourself, I mean, it seems relatively quick that people talk to you about being a role model for this community.
Yeah.
That's a big jump from, I'm going to tell some friends, to now you're, you know, yeah, a role model, a spokesperson, you know?
Wow.
On some level, whether,
well,
you know.
Well, I think what it is, at least for me, you know, like there were people that have come out and, you know, like Hari Neff or Teddy, I've always never know how to say her freaking last name, but I like her. Her name's Teddy.
Okay.
Quinn Levin.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. But her, you know, and just like seeing people come out and be accepted is huge. And I think, and it was huge for me. And so I think even just the act of me coming out and being accepted by the community that I'm in and continuing to work with all these people and feeling like I can be a person and kind of let all this that's been a part of me, like, put it out there. I think even just that is, like, can be inspiring to people.
Yeah.
Not even that I have to do much, you know? It's like just doing
just be
that
yourself.
I think is, yeah.
Absolutely.
Because I'm not much of a, I don't know. I don't like attention.
It's amazing how much irony is in that, considering I think people would be surprised how many artists in the broader sense,
yeah,
but certainly musician artists, don't really like attention. They like writing music.
Yeah.
And they want the world to hear the music because they like the music, but it's not really about the attention.
Oh, totally.
It's so hard to explain that to people that songwriters and artists aren't always...
Yeah.
Even if they're on stage being loud and jumping around and dancing and stuff, when you're with those people off stage, a lot of them are reclusive or they're quiet, not because, you know, maybe they go on stage because of anxiety. And they actually like being in front of people because they need it to help with anxiety. It's mm-hmm. like the opposite of what you think the purpose is, you know?
Sure.
That said, so, you know, right during all this, you work on the Shawn Mendes album, self-titled, which you end up with 11 songs on it, including In My Blood, which is my wife's favorite song. We listen to that a lot. Album debuts number one. You end up continuing on this Shawn Mendes train.
Mm-hmm.
And because this, you end up with more involved with Shawn on this. And it's the first album that really comes out with you being yourself mm-hmm. as a human. Do you think that's why it's so successful? Do you think, like, you're sort of... I mean, obviously, Shawn is a successful artist, but do you feel like you were able to be different as a artist, as a producer, as a writer?
Well, no, I think it's... A lot of it is successful because of how Shawn works and how hard he works. I definitely would not have been able to do the work that I did had I done it 2 years ago. Not even just because, like, there was so much going on with me personally, so much smoking, so much this and that. Like, I literally wouldn't have been able to sit in the chair and produce everything right. that I did. So, right. like, just being more focused, being more, you know, everything allowed me to do it. Because it ended up being a lot of work. It's the only record that I've ever, like, produced. You know, I didn't do every song, but I did all except for, like, two or three on there production, which is the most they've done even just in a year on other stuff. You know, the year before I did like four of the songs on Illuminate that I produced, and then, you know, maybe did like two other things that kind of just happened to work out from like demos the day of. But it was the first time I was like, okay, I have to get whatever, like, 14, 15 songs done.
How do you feel about being the, you know, it's a different sort of pressure being the main kind of producer of something.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I love it. I love doing production stuff, and like, that's kind of always been the goal.
Sure.
And like, I love writing and stuff too, but I love sounds. I love playing with sounds. I love, like,
Scott Harris, who we'll get to later.
I love Scott.
What was that?
I love Scott.
Yeah, your main co-writer with Shawn.
Yeah,
you know, if not even outside of that, but, you know, Scott showed me. He didn't show me. He was telling me about the voice notes that Shawn sends.
Oh yeah,
and how he's gotten. He's at the point in his life where he's so creative mm-hmm. because he's just like, cells are splitting still.
Yeah.
And that it's just like, it's almost hard to keep up with good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about working with Shawn Mendes.
Dude. Okay. I don't know. He's so fucking talented, is kind of where to start. It's like... He picks things up so fast. He's super creative. It's like, you know, when I met him, he had just learned to play the guitar like a few months before. And now this isn't even like that many years later. And like, he's playing on every single record. And like, I don't know, you know, like he'll pick up, he picked up the drums while we were working on this last record in like a few days. And like, and the other thing about him is he really knows like what he wants things to sound like. And in working with him, it's like he like feels it or not, kind of, you know, and, and he'll know when things don't feel right, and he knows how to like make suggestions to get it where it's feeling right, which like makes my job a lot easier too, because it's not like,
well, it's not like I can do what I'm doing. When you were in LA as an artist, and where you were like not totally sure what you didn't want, or you knew what you liked, and it's different than somebody who's able to communicate that.
Right.
You know.
And then I can do what I do, and then, you know, he'll light up at one thing and it'll be like, oh, cool, like, let's go over there. And then he does something and it's like, okay, amazing. Yeah, like, put that down in it. I don't know. I just feel the energy with him feels so good. And like, he's so legit and just like knows. I don't know. It just feels good. It feels like it's the right thing.
I want to go to the next segment, but before that, you know, just your year so far, not only that, but to work with Leon Bridges, who's amazing. And this 5 Seconds of Summer album's totally legit. You had, you know, stuff on a lot of these things. Christina Aguilera. You know, really impressive how many songs you have out as a co-writer, but I really want to get, I really want to hear about your project.
Okay.
You know? Tell me about it.
Well, what do you want to know?
I mean, what's it like to, I've been working on a project for a long time where it's really important that I have 100, that I write 100% of the lyrics and melodies.
Okay.
For me, this was like the first time where I can be like, okay, this is what I sound like as me.
Yes.
I'm not a very good producer, and I happen to work with Ricky Reed, who's an icon.
Yeah.
So, you know, to, he allows me to be the writer I want to be in this format, and it's incredible to have that. But to me, what matters, I just wanted to have something that as a lyricist and as a melody writer, this is mine.
Yeah.
Something that I'm willing to slave over to show this is what I wanna,
yeah,
you know, what I wanna be. So that's really sort of the point of what you're doing.
Yeah, you said it.
You know, and I don't know. I mean, we don't really get that many shots at it unless we take them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A lot, nobody's offering it. You have to do it.
Yeah,
and
you
that's
have to
like
make
a
it.
That takes time, it takes a risk, and it's vulnerable.
Right.
And especially when you don't really want the magnifying glass on you, but you just want to set the record straight in a way.
Totally.
you know?
Yeah, because we're involved in so many different things. And then it's like, but when I'm kind of left alone in a room, like this is what like you want people to know what you sound like. And I don't know why. I just do. Like I'm, because like they're the sounds I like, and they're like what I like. I like to make it and hear it, and I don't know. I just want people to hear it.
Why did you start doing it? I mean, when in the middle of you're doing all these records, and you're going to go take time away.
Oh, a lot of it's old.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. I kind of made it. Some of them are like from 2011. They're like all demos that I've had sitting around, and a couple things that I did like over the past 2-3 years.
Doesn't it make you want to follow it up with sort of what you would sound like now?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is kind of, so what I did was I took them, and when I was done with the Sean album, I kind of took some time off to like recuperate and just take some time off and not make stuff. But then I ended up making, basically I had these demos in a folder that I was like, oh, all these would sound good together. And I kind of just found all the different sessions and opened them up and like replaced a bunch of the drums with like sounds that I would use now and like cut guitars on them. So they all kind of have similar like palette of guitar stuff throughout. And I put some piano on them, and one I completely like redid and just kept the vocals and finished it like an album. Because after I'd done the Sean thing, I was like, oh, cool, like making an album, like think about it like this or whatever. And I kind of did the same thing with those demos and finished it up. And yeah, now, and I also imagine like, oh, cool, like if I can do something with this, then that'll create more of an opportunity for me to have more time to do more. Because things do get busy. But like if I have like stuff out and there's like, I can like generate something with that, then like sure. that can create more time for me. The same way like by writing songs for other people, I've been able to create more time for me to write songs for other people.
Yeah, they all feed each other.
Yeah.
I think what's cool is when you really write music for yourself, that there isn't a time limit on it because no one else was releasing it. So if you were, you know, if you look at a song from 2011 or a song from now and it's really you, and then there it was never dated because no one else releases your music.
Right.
Does that make sense? I know that's totally. Kind of weird, but.
But it would be cool to have somebody be like, here's a chunk of money and make your record.
Yeah.
Like, okay, cool. Because then it would be nice to like be obligated to make my own music.
Do you think that's what this is going to lead towards?
I don't know.
Yeah.
That'd be cool though.
I'll sign you.
Sick.
It's a deal. All right. This next segment, I'm going to list five people. Just tell me the first thing that comes off the top of your head. We already did Sean pretty much.
Okay.
But he's on the list. So I'll give you another crack at it. Shawn Mendes.
Genius.
Casey Robinson.
Oh, just the best. Everybody I know. I know because of Casey.
I love that you mentioned Silverstein and Casey because, you know, they're both producers of the podcast.
Yeah.
And they're both longtime friends of ours. And
yeah.
they do their job as well as anybody on the planet.
It's amazing.
You know.
I've never, yeah.
I always tell people this, but you know Casey and I were on the same floor freshman year of college.
Yes.
That's my,
it's amazing.
That's my favorite tidbit about Casey.
I see it
all the time.
Yeah.
In a way that kind of reminds me of like what you and John have, where it's just like Casey knows me as playing, you know,
yes.
Crash on my guitar because Dave Matthews is huge.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
You know, long before whatever has gone on since. Let's go with Ricky Reed.
Ricky Reed, again, I just genius, but also like, oh, I love him. Just everything. He's so good. And so like, he's such a good listener and also so focused. And like, I don't know, like he more than anybody else can like consistently just put together like amazing pop. It's like you just go in day, 6 hours later, like this is gonna be on the radio, like just consistently, like every day, like and how, and like is so good with like a group of people where like everybody's doing little things and he'll hear somebody in the back of the room who like he'll be like that, you know, and like you didn't even think he was
paying attention.
You thought he was into what he's doing, which he was, but he's also kind of like the ambient noise in the room, like if something happens, like he's so good at just pulling these things and I don't know, he's just really good.
We're in the mix phase Special. Of what we've been working on, and his meticulous nature when it comes to mixes is something I've never seen in 20 years of being in LA. I've never seen anything like that. It's shocking. Yeah. John Ryan,
best friend, also genius, amazing. Oh, what about John? Has such good energy. John, okay, like when we were in, we did the Jamaica camp, and like the whole camp, the whatever, what was it, BMG and Big Deal had the camp at G Jam. And like the end, the last night of that camp was basically everybody in John's room all making like this one like amazing thing that John was kind of like champ, like just like the leader of this, like there were maybe like 30 people in this like one little studio room all making this thing, and just he has that sort of energy that like makes that happen, like everybody wants to be in that room and making whatever kind of he's working on, because he just does this cool, I don't know, it's a great song, and like just, yeah, amazing.
Scott Harris.
Everybody's a genius.
Yeah, these are like really some top of the line talent.
Yeah. Scott is so good at so many things. But like, I always think of Scott as being so amazing at lyrics and so amazing at like tying a lyric together and like finding the heart of a lyric and just pulling that whole thing together. And he does that so well with Sean and is like such a, I don't know, he's just so good at that. And then he's also really good at like, his guitar stuff is amazing. Like when we were doing Treat You Better, he was playing, it was kind of this thing. And at the last minute, he just kind of played the main riff. And it was like this very simple, it had taken so many forms, but he's just, I don't know. And like, it's like when I hear the Don't Let Me Down song, like I can just so hear him in that. I don't know. He has like a very special thing. And I've known him. That sounds bad. I've known him for so long. We toured together.
Really?
When I was 17.
Oh, that's right. In his band, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah. We like toured together for a few months, which is crazy.
I love that. You know what? I'm doing 7. I don't care.
Okay.
People can turn it off. Whatever. Screw you guys. Julian Bonetta.
Julian Bonetta. Okay. Again, Gene, like now I have to say it for everyone because they
just,
are. But
it's just all part of the same group. But, you know, they each have their own lane for you. Like, you have a publishing deal through the Bonettas.
Yeah.
You know, you were in high school with John. You toured with Scott. You do music with Ricky. Yeah. Casey's your publisher. Even though you guys are friends, these people are career collaborators, which is why it feels weird not to give you a chance to say something about them.
Totally.
Just because they're all part of the same group, you have individual relationships with all of them.
Yeah.
You know? So, Julian.
So, Julian is, there is one, we were at, okay, so we gave each other all names, and John was the hammer, I was Pussy Ninja, and Julian was Constant Gardener. And I always think about that because he's so good at starting an idea and then like refining it and like getting to the heart of what it is and then like refining it and tweaking this thing and tweaking that thing and bringing, you know, ooh, like this person would be really good to like bring into what this idea is. And like, you know, it's so cool. He does the Bonettas do the camp, the Palm Springs camp every year. And he's like the perfect person to have at a camp like that because he's so good at just going from room to room and like just kind of like gardening all of these different ideas and like bringing people together and mashing them together. And then obviously as a producer, he's just like amazing and his sounds are amazing. And like he just makes things sound so good. But also just his approach to like working on stuff and his vision for songs and like his feel for that and his ability to like work with other people and kind of like, I don't know, just like craft something is like really good and bring people into stuff at the right time. And like, he's awesome.
Your manager, Ollie, last one.
He's the best. Okay. I wouldn't be doing anything if it weren't for Ollie. When I met Ollie, we started like, it's hard to say because we have such like a good management partnership and I'd like met with a lot of managers and whatever. And then we started talking and he just like got what I wanted to do and was able to like take, like apply strategy to that and like work with me to like really do the sorts of things I wanted to do. And like, he's just like, like moving through everything, he's, I don't know, he just like gets it and is able to kind of put one and two together. And I feel like I can tell him anything. And like, he's always like, I can kind of just like vent and tell him everything and everything about how I feel and where I want to be and what I want to do and not be afraid that he's going to be like, oh, bitch, you're crazy. Like, it all kind of is like, he's like, okay, and like processes it and then really just like helps me
figure it out.
Figure out like, okay, how am I going to plan for like 5 years down the road? Because I'm so not that kind of person. I'm very lucky to have somebody like him. He's the shit.
Well, Teddy Geiger, thank you for doing this podcast. Thank you for being my friend.
Thank you for having me and being my friend.
You're doing something that is absolutely, for a songwriter, just the absolute dream, where you can both write and help define one of the world's biggest pop stars with them and continue to do that, and then also be able to do so many different types of music, you know, and to work with your friends and your friends still working with you. It all says the kind of human you are, that people have stuck with you through high school all the way to now. I don't know that many people who can say they collaborated with people from that far back and currently are still making music with them, and progressive music and worldwide music. I just can't applaud you enough for that. And thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
You are awesome.
I feel so good about myself now.
Good. Let's write a song.
Okay. Yay.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silverstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.